So, Ms. Curtin, could you please call our next matter for oral argument?
Yes, calling case May 18-1428, in the matter of the welfare of the child of CF and JB.
Okay. Mr. Gorman, before I begin, I'll just note on the record we are having a division of time, as I understand it, with respect to respondents. And Ms. Nicholson, you're taking 12 minutes?
Correct.
And Ms. Chadwick will take three?
Yes, sir.
And speak in that order?
Correct.
Okay, so we're going to try and set our time clock to reflect those individual time segments.
Thank you very much.
So, all right, Mr. Gorman.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Peter Gorman of the Hennepin County Public Defender, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Jabari Bell. The standards of review that the court uses on the issues that I've raised before you, I've tried to cover them in the brief, and I won't cover them again here. Now, I recognize that in child protection cases, the law exists to serve the best interests of the child. And I'm not going to stand here and tell you that my client won the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval for Parenthood in the last 2 years, because he didn't. But I am going to tell you, as I stated at the end of the principal brief, that my client and all parents have a substantive due process right to parenthood and a procedural due process right to fair treatment. And it is our position, and the reason why we're here, is that he was unfairly treated and he was deprived of both substantive and procedural due process. Now, I'd like to spend a few seconds talking about rules. We all have rules set in various stages of life that we walk through every day. Rules are established to govern behaviors and to prevent chaos in society. If we have rules and we don't follow them, it demonstrates a contempt for the rules, and it demonstrates to others that they don't have to follow the rules either. And I'd like to submit to you that we have numerous rule violations here, which taken together deprived my client of fair proceedings. Now, as I said near the end of the principal brief, I'm not claiming that any one of these six issues that I've brought before you would in and of itself be enough to reverse. But I am claiming that the six issues combined with each other show that he was not fairly treated. And I'd like to tell you why. The violations of the rules that took place in this case show a contempt for the relative search rule, a contempt for the case plan rule, a contempt for the rule requiring guardians to write reports, but at worst, it also shows a contempt for the presumption that a natural parent is presumed capable to raise his or her child. Now, what I'd like to start out with is this business about this amended petition. We have a TPR petition from September of 17. Then we have a TPR petition amended from January of 18. Both of those petitions were filed against CF and TT. Both of them named Mr. Bell, but little more. Now, the county attorney says in her brief that there were allegations of substance in the amended petition that applied to Mr. Bell. They didn't. The allegations in the petition apply to CF and TT, not to Mr. Bell. But at a preliminary hearing in 2018, we have the county attorney standing up. It's almost like Gilda Radner on Saturday Night Live. Remember that character she used to play who was hearing impaired, and she would get a news story wrong, and she would smile and say, oh, never mind. That's what happened here. They go, never mind, to the petitions that they filed that dealt with CC and TF. And
what about, didn't the amended petition, I don't have it in front of me, I just have a description of it in front of me, but didn't it make factual allegations? For example, that the department made several attempts to contact Mr. Bell, establish adjudication, offer a case plan. He was not compliant, had not visited the child. I mean, were those not related to him?
Well, the fact is they made one contact with him in October of 2016, and then they made another contact with him in, I think it was February of 2017. But even if you take at its face that paragraph that you just read from, that doesn't establish enough to prove a 1B2, a 1B4, a 1B5, or a 1B8, which is what this petition alleged. So what the county attorney did is they say, never mind that fact that we alleged in this petition against CF and TT, we now want this petition to apply to JB. But there isn't a word in the petition, essentially, that applies to JB.
Well, there are words. You just don't think there are enough. I mean, it's not correct to say there are no words in there. I just read them.
Well, all they said is the department attempted to contact him. Attempted.
And established adjudication, offered a case plan. He was not compliant with the department's attempts, and he has not visited the child since the child was in placement.
He hasn't visited the child because they wouldn't let him.
Right. I'm not getting into the merits of it. I'm just getting into what's in the petition.
He tried to
there
visit.
Are words about him in the petition.
What remains in this petition after you strip away everything that has to do with TT and CF is not clear and convincing evidence. And as I've argued to you in the principal brief, it's not even a prima facie case for termination of parental rights. And so what they do is they stand up and they make an oral amendment, and they say, we want to take away CF and TT from this petition and make it a petition against JB. But you know what? And the court allowed her to do that. But you know what? They never even filed an amended petition. And this case went to trial on a petition that was orally amended to substitute JB for CF and TT. And you know, I really hate to stand up here and give you cases that are not cited in the briefs. But yesterday, while I was preparing, I remembered a case that I had a piece of about a decade ago. And I'd like to give you the cite to it. It's Welfare of the Child of BJM and HW. And it's reported at 744 Northwest 2nd, 669. And this was a case where the Supreme Court reversed a termination, where an amended petition was filed, and they didn't name HW, who was my client. And by the way, I should clarify.
Mr. Gorman, you know, you started out by talking about rules and what rules need to be followed. What is it that you think the county should have done?
I mean,
it sounds to me, your client was an absent father, knew he had a child, didn't want to participate, and only moved in. We haven't talked about the fact that the guardian ad litem testified that he wanted only to intervene to direct placement of the child with the grandmother.
Now, that's not a true statement of what the record is. JB never, ever once said anything about CF's plan to reunify him with the maternal grandmother. That was CF's plan.
Let's back up. What should the county have done?
The agency, when they reached him in October of 16, should have said, do you have any relatives that we could consider? Do you have a chemical dependency problem? We'd like to offer you services. Now, remember, in the fall of 2016, they didn't know the first thing about this guy. They assumed that he needed chemical dependency evaluation because the mother of the child was an intoxicant abuser. They knew nothing about JB. So they could have said, do you have parents? Do you have uncles, aunts, grandparents that we could place this child with? Because we're about to place the child with a stranger. And they did place the child with a stranger. They could have said, how many kids have you raised? And they would have learned that he had had three children. He hadn't specifically raised all three of them.
Back to that contact in October. And at that point, your client is made aware that these petitions are pending. And the county then included him as a part of a plan, correct?
Well, this case plan was written.
I guess what I'm getting at is, how is the county going to find out this information until you get involved with the plan? And he was gone, absent in Tennessee, didn't have a residence, didn't.
He had a residence in Tennessee. They never checked it out. He had an apartment. They could have called the social services in Shelby County, Tennessee, and had them check out his home. They didn't do that. They didn't ask him if he had any relatives in Twin Cities or anywhere else who could be foster care providers. The case plan wasn't even written until January of 2018, wasn't even signed until April of 2018, and wasn't even filed in court until the day of the pretrial hearing, 3 weeks before trial. That's when they filed the case plan. But they might have said to him, tell us about your parenting. We'd like to know if you need a parenting assessment. Tell us about your intoxicant use, if you use any. We might want to have you do a chemical dependency assessment. But they didn't do any of that. And then in 2017, and this still goes to the question you asked me, Your Honor, in 2017, they basically ignored him. And Judge Cahill said in his findings that he was a stranger to the agency for about 10 months in 2017. And that's because TT perjured himself and signed a recognition of parentage that he was the father when in fact he wasn't the father, and the agency knew that he wasn't the father. The agency knew there was 99% blood genetics that showed that JB was the father. And look through these transcripts you've got here.
But he had gotten himself adjudicated the father.
Pardon
me? He had taken no action to become adjudicated the father until when, 2018?
You know what, though? I fine-toothed that statute yesterday while preparing all of Chapter 257, at least the Parentage Act portion of 257. There's no requirement that I found that he had to adjudicate himself. Now, the child protection...
He adjudicated himself, but he didn't list himself in the parent... I can't remember what that's called. Where the father is...
The fatherhood index?
Yes.
I suppose he could have, but...
I mean, I'm troubled by the fact that he's shrugged off and basically done nothing to not be a stranger to the case when he knew the case is, when he knew the child is there.
He didn't do nothing in 2018. In 2018, he got active. He made numerous contacts with the protection worker. He dropped by her office on January 6th of 20...
Plan, then.
Pardon
so
me?
Now in 2018,
in 2018.
He now has a plan.
In 2018, he dropped by the protection worker's office without an appointment. The case plan had not been written yet at that point.
He was informed of the plan.
If you look at Exhibit 45, it's a little unclear. There's 215 pages in Exhibit 45. And there are inconsistent statements in that. He said in his trial testimony that he knew that he was supposed to do UAs, he was supposed to do a parenting assessment, and he was supposed to keep a job and have a house. He had a house, he had a job, he did a chemical dependency assessment, and he did a parenthood assessment. So those are the four things that he testified that he thought he was supposed to do. But in 2018, he starts calling the protection worker in a way that he hadn't the prior year. But let's remember that in 2017, they treated him as a total stranger. And Judge Cahill so found. So we have about 10 or 11 months.
But not really over his objection. I mean, someone else signed a recognition of parentage and was a...
Someone
right,
else
and
perjured
was a legal,
himself in signing a recognition of parentage.
It was a legal parent at that point under that ROP, and he took no action against that, right?
But the statute allows a presumption when the blood test is over 99%. The statute carries with it a presumption that he is, in fact, the biological father. And these people knew he was the biological father. They created this fiction that they couldn't offer him services, and instead they offered services to a repeat domestic abuser who perjured himself in this affidavit of parentage. Why they offered services for a whole year to a guy that they knew was not the parent is beyond me.
I just want to draw your attention, because your time, of course, is running, but looking at the district court's findings, the district court did find Mr. Bell to provide, he says, testimony that was self-serving, inaccurate, and inconsistent with the record. And, you know, obviously he gave his testimony less weight. But one of these things with respect to the timing was, you know, Mr. Bell claimed he hadn't seen his child since 2016, and he didn't know child protection was involved. And the district court found that to be inaccurate.
I think he probably knew when the child protection people called him in October of 2016 that the child was in the child protection system. Now, I wasn't a party to any of those calls, but I think the evidence shows that. I don't
then
think...
the department reached out to him, at least according to the court's findings.
Well, they reached out to him once.
No bail until October of 17.
They reached out to him once, and the dictation shows that they made a couple of other attempted phone calls without getting through. But in 2018, which is the period of time that counts here, He's very active. He's calling the protection worker all the time, but he's got this job.
Not engaging in the plan, and you know, and that's what the judge said. You have visitation. You got to follow the plan. You got to take your UAs. If you can't say where you're going to be to take your UAs, you're in. You're not compliant.
Show me one word in this record that he needed any one of those services.
He met with the worker in January 2018. That's what we're talking about. That's what you're trying to focus on. He was a part of the development of that plan. If he did not feel that the UA requirements were applicable to him, that's the point that he could say, hey.
There isn't anything in this record that says that they complied with the statute in roping him in to the requirements of the case plan. Not a single word. The statute requires that he be a part of the preparation of that case plan. There's nothing in the record that says that he was.
It shows that he came in at the request of the worker. They worked on a plan together.
He did come in without an appointment, and he also came in on a week's notice for another appointment, but there's nothing in the record that I have that we have that shows that he participated in the preparation of the plan, which is another one of the rules that we have that is a requirement and wasn't complied with.
Thank you, Mr. Vaughn.
Thank you.
As you know, you'll have time for rebuttal. We'll hear from counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Britta Nicholson, appearing on behalf of respondent Hennepin County. Also present is Allison Chadwick, student attorney, appearing on behalf of the guardian ad litem. And as previously discussed on the record, the plan for us moving forward is that I will speak on behalf of the county for 12 minutes, and Ms. Chadwick will speak on behalf of the guardian ad litem for 3 minutes. The general plan is that Ms. Chadwick intends to address appellant's arguments regarding the guardian ad litem's testimony at trial. I would like to begin by addressing the scope that is before Your Honors on appeal. Appellate does not specifically challenge the district court's findings regarding the statutory grounds for terminations or that a termination is in the child's best interests. As a result, those findings should be upheld. As stated in my brief, appellant had virtually no relationship with the child, did not visit with the child during the 21 months of the CHIPS case, and for 15 months, appellant was resistant to the department's efforts to assist him with establishing paternity and with developing a case plan with the department. In January 2018, he finally made himself available to the department. He met with the social worker, and they developed a specific case plan based on his needs.
Well, Mr. Gorman says that's not true. So what does the record bear out in terms of the fact that there was involvement in shaping this plan?
Thank you, Your Honor. That would be Exhibit 45, which is the worker's case notes, and also the exhibit that is the case plan itself. Very plainly on the first page of that document says that Dominique Brown, the child protection worker, met with Mr. Bell in January to jointly make this plan. And if you look at her case note from that meeting, it states that they did discuss his needs. For example, he stated that he did smoke marijuana. He said he would switch to wine in order to get his daughter back. But again, that just reveals a lack of insight into substance use and its impact on his parenting, especially given this child's history and the environment that she came from. So based on Exhibit 45, the case notes, and the plain face of the case plan document itself, it is clear that Mr. Bell was present at a meeting with the department. He did disclose some issues, and the department developed with Mr. Bell an appropriate case plan. And in addition, he, on the back page of the case plan, you see his signature where he checked the boxes that this case plan was explained to me, and he received a copy of the case plan. So thus, he was involved in the development and implementation, and he was fully aware of the elements of that case plan. And after that case plan was developed in January 2018, it is important to note that Mr. Bell then completely failed to comply for an additional 6 months before the trial date. The department made referrals and set him up for UAs, which he failed to provide. The three he did provide were positive for marijuana. They made the referral for parenting education, and Mr. Bell failed to engage. There was a period of 5 months where he was supposed to be meeting weekly with the parenting worker, and he only met with her 4 or 5 times. As you can see from the parenting worker's notes, she made ongoing efforts to engage him, and he would repeatedly decline, say he was out of town, and that he would schedule. In that document, it also shows that Mr. Bell himself told the parenting worker that he planned to give the child back to the maternal grandmother, even though it was legally unallowed, was the language that was used in the exhibit. In addition, the department made ongoing efforts to meet with Mr. Bell and discuss his case plan with him. They offered to set up UAs at a location of his preference, whatever state he was in. He never responded to say what state that was. The department would have checked out his home, as Ms. Brown testified, but Mr. Bell never gave an actual location and was not forthcoming about where he was living. There were also concerns that he was living part-time with the maternal grandmother, and he acknowledged himself that there was substance use in that home. And as Ms. Brown testified, that would place Talia back in the exact same environment that led to the case opening in the first place. In addition, Talia is a child with a history of instability, and the record makes clear that Mr. Bell is an unstable, inconsistent individual who has not been involved in her life, and she needed permanency after being an out-of-home placement for over 21 months. So for all of those reasons, there were statutory grounds, and it was in her best interests.
If Ms. Nicholson, if going forward, you could just use initials for the child. That would be our preference.
I apologize. Thank you. Appellant's arguments focus on procedural issues and the department's reasonable efforts. However, the department did make reasonable efforts in this case. Appellant already conceded that the first contact was in October 2016, and at that time, Mr. Bell was aware that his child was in out-of-home placement and that the department was making efforts to establish paternity and also involve him in the case. There were repeated phone calls referenced in Exhibit 45 and also in my brief in which the child protection social worker was trying to make contact with him, encouraging him to come back to Minnesota to establish paternity and discuss a case plan. In all of those phone calls, Mr. Bell would always say that he was out of state but would be returning in a few weeks. The department would follow up in a few weeks, and he would make the same statement yet again. Despite knowing that his child was in out-of-home placement, he did nothing to establish paternity or become involved for over 15 months. As Your Honor previously noted, he only became involved after the mother terminated her parental rights and reached out to Mr. Bell, urging him to become involved to get the child, to return the child to maternal relatives. His lack of involvement early on in the case severely hampered the department's ability to offer him a case plan. His lack of communication and his lack of a consistent location made it difficult for the department to offer him services or make referrals. Reasonable efforts are defined as those that are reasonable under the circumstances, and unfortunately in this case, Mr. Bell's actions severely hampered the department's ability to offer him a case plan, but they did act very reasonably by persistently reaching out to him and encouraging him to be involved in the case.
I mean, unlike some circumstances, it seemed here that Mr. Bell, he was a truck driver, if I recall the record correctly. I mean, he drove over the road.
He stated that he had multiple occupations. I believe truck driving was one of them. He also stated that he worked for moving companies on a somewhat freelance basis.
Right. So, I mean, he had a vocational reason to be gone and unable to maintain perhaps regular contact with the county.
Arguably, yes, Your Honor. However, in these circumstances, especially in the context of a child protection case where he knows his traumatized child is in out-of-home placement and his parental rights are at stake, it would be reasonable for him to relocate to Minnesota, as he did finally in May of 2018. He said he had relocated and was willing to stay. So he clearly had the ability to do so, but just lacked the motivation to do so earlier in the case. In addition, the concern here was that he was not forthcoming with the department about his actual occupation, about his actual residence, which severely hampered the department's ability to engage him in those circumstances. As I noted previously, the department said, well, what state are you living in? We can try to arrange UAs in that state that would be most convenient for you. Mr. Bell never responded. The department was willing to look at his home, but he was never forthcoming about where that actually was. So due to his lack of being forthcoming and his clear lack of motivation to be involved in the child's life, that is the issue that severely hampered the department's ability to offer him a case plan.
What were the circumstances around his request for a continuance? He wanted more time to work on the plan.
Correct. That request was made in the June 2018 hearing, and it was based at the time on
counsel. Pretrial. It wasn't at the date or on the brink of the TPR hearing.
Correct. It was at the pretrial hearing. The trial occurred approximately 1 month later, and the argument there was that the written case plan had only been filed that day. However, the record makes clear that Mr. Bell was fully aware of the contents of his case plan starting in January 2018, and his actions also show that he was aware of it, as did his testimony. He He did try to provide some UAs. He testified that he knew he was on the color code. He did try to engage in parenting education. He repeatedly spoke to the parenting educator and made excuses about why he couldn't engage. So that is why the court denied the continuance, is that he was fully aware of his case plan. He had plenty of time to work on it, and he just failed to do so. In addition, the Rule 5 of the Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure states that a continuance may only be granted if it won't delay the permanency timelines. In this case, they were already well beyond the permanency timelines. This child had been in out-of-home placement for 21 months. Mr. Bell himself was the one that caused the delay due to his lack of availability, and he should not have been granted the benefit of a continuance at the expense of his daughter. So for those reasons, the court properly denied that continuance.
Could you speak, please, to the sufficiency of the amended petition, just the petition itself, to establish or assert a prima facie case?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, that amended petition was filed in January of 2018. It was amended to list Mr. Bell as the presumed father based on genetic testing. It named him as a party to the proceedings, and page 6 of that petition does contain factual allegations about the department's efforts to engage him, the fact that he did not respond, he did not work a case plan, and he had not visited with his child. As articulated in my brief, although that paragraph about Mr. Bell was brief, it was about Mr. Bell, and it was brief because, quite frankly, he hadn't done much by the time that petition was filed. The department had made efforts, and he hadn't responded. So that was really all of the information the department was able to provide to the court. And as I stated in my brief, those allegations do support a TPR on any of the three grounds that were ultimately found. For example, neglect of the parent-child duties by failing to establish paternity, failing to complete a case plan, and failing to visit his child. For example, subdivision 5, failure to correct the conditions. That is due to, again, his failure to complete a case plan and cooperate with the department. And finally, neglected and in foster care. The petition made clear that the child had been in court-ordered foster care for a significant period of time and that Mr. Bell had not visited with the child and had not engaged in services. So for all those reasons, there is a clear prima facie showing in that amended petition, and it was argued at the April hearing. So as I mentioned, the focus on the June hearing is utterly misplaced. At that April hearing, which was the first appearance with counsel after the TPR, amended TPR petition was filed, counsel for Mr. Bell argued that there was a lack of a prima facie case. The department reiterated the fact that he had not established paternity, was not in contact with the department, had not visited the child, and the court ultimately found that there was a prima facie showing for that case to move forward. The alleged oral amendments that counsel refers to in the June hearing were merely just reinforcing the fact that there is a petition pending that is specific to Mr. Bell. It was a reaffirmation. It was not a complete substantive amendment of the petition. So for those reasons, there is a clear prima facie grounds on that amended petition, and Mr. Bell was very much on notice of these proceedings and the department's concerns. Even in his testimony himself, he was able to articulate what concerns the departments had with his parenting, including contact with maternal relatives, his mental capacity to care for the child, and his understanding of the child's needs. Moving on now to the written out-of-home placement plan. Any delay in that written out-of-home placement plan was purely due to Mr. Bell himself. It was not the fault of the department. Mr. Bell did not make himself fully available until January of 2018, despite the department's efforts to contact him in October 2016, November 2016, and the beginning of January, February, and March of 2017, August 2017, and October 2017, and December 2017. All of those contacts are listed in Exhibit 45, but Mr. Bell did not make himself available until January 2018. As we previously discussed, that is the date that they met, fully developed the case plan, and appellant agreed to his case plan, very importantly, at that meeting. He signed the out-of-home placement plan in April, again reaffirming that he received it, understood it, and agreed with it. And he did not actually establish paternity for this child legally until May of 2018. And then the out-of-home placement plan was appropriately filed a mere 24 days later in June. And I see that my time is up, so thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Nicholson.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Allison Chadwick, and I'm here today on behalf of the guardian ad litem, Amy Krizga. I'm here today with my supervising attorney, Perry Moriarty. This court should affirm the district court's decision denying appellant's motion to preclude the guardian ad litem's testimony for both procedural and logical reasons. The plain language of Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure 38.11 requires that the guardian ad litem supply a written report for four types of hearings. All four of these hearings are hearings in which testimony is typically not taken. This includes a review hearing, a permanent placement review hearing, review of a child under the guardianship of the Commissioner of Human Services, and any reviews conducted regarding a child in the permanent custody of the agency. The guardian ad litem in this case attended an admit-deny hearing, a pretrial, and a trial. None of these hearings required that she write a report. Additionally, the guardian ad litem at trial testified consistently with this, stating that the Hennepin County guardian ad litem's office policy is that guardian ad litems do not write reports until the child is a ward of the state. It is important to note that the guardian ad litem in this case was a party and not an expert witness. A party is not required to supply a written report before testifying. Additionally, appellant has offered no valid legal basis for his contention that a remedy to a Rule 38 violation would be to preclude the guardian ad litem's testimony. At trial, appellant acknowledged that Rule 38 is interpreted differently in Hennepin County, that guardian ad litems are not required to supply a written report pre-adjudication, but that other counties in Minnesota do require this. Appellant's brief also states that testimony preclusion is an available remedy in criminal trials and should be allowed here as well, not that it already is. Current law did not require that the guardian ad litem write a report prior to trial. Logically, in addition to the lack of any procedural requirement that the guardian ad litem supply a written report, the guardian ad litem is in the best position to provide testimony to the court on behalf of TMDB's best interest. The guardian ad litem visited with TMDB approximately 12 times since being appointed in September of 2017. She met with her foster parents, her biological parents when possible, and the social worker. She reviewed the out-of-home placement plans, personal health records, and all other documents supplied to her. For the reasons I have mentioned, as well as those made by Ms. Nicholson, we respectfully ask that this court affirm the district court's ruling terminating appellant's parental rights. Thank you.
Any questions? No. Thank you, Ms. Chadwick. Rebuttal, Mr. Gorman?
On this business about reports by the guardian, I have to assume that my reply brief didn't reach Ms. Chadwick. It was mailed to Professor Sanderson, who at that time was the supervising lawyer. But I have addressed this claim in the reply brief. The guardian is completely mistaken about the wording of the rule, and I don't think it's necessary to address that point any longer. I realized after I sat down that I was going to tell you about the BJM and HW case that I took part in back in 2008 or 2007 or something. I ended up trying that case on remand from the Supreme Court, which reversed the TPR. But the reason why I think that's worth looking at is there was an amended petition. HW was not named, and he was not even served with the petition. But for reasons that remain a mystery to me even after all this time, my colleague allowed that case to go to trial without him ever having even been served with the petition. It's true that those three lines, Judge Smith, that you read to me appear in the January 18th, 2018 petition. But this is a 10-page petition, and this is three lines. All the rest of it deals with TT and CF, not with JB. So I think I've probably spent enough time talking about the oral amendment to the petition and having him go to trial on a really, I might even call it a pretend petition to go to trial in July. There have been some questions about the services and his participation. I'd like to call your attention to the case that I gave you in the first argument in the principal brief, which holds that if there's no need for services, then services don't need to be offered, and the juvenile court lacks jurisdiction. At the time that these people started telling Mr. Bell that he had to do this and that and the other thing, they didn't know one thing about him, and they in particular didn't know whether he had any chemical dependency problem. Now, normally in these cases, a person doesn't go on the color wheel unless the person is thought to have a severe chemical dependency problem. They knew nothing about this guy.
He didn't tell them, did he not, that he used marijuana?
Well, lots of people use marijuana.
I'm just saying. I mean, they had that information.
They had that. But look.
Because you're saying they knew nothing.
When my kids were little, I used alcohol, and I used a little pot, too, a long time ago. But you're not going to make me a chemically dependent person and make me go to a chemical dependency assessment. All he said is, I use a little pot because I have injuries from truck driving.
But he signed the plan.
Pardon me?
He signed the plan.
What, the UAs?
He signed the plan that required that.
Well, he should have had a lawyer there. The statute requires that he have a lawyer there, and he didn't have a lawyer there. I have no idea why he signed that plan. I wouldn't have. But there was absolutely no need for services. They didn't need a parenting assessment. They didn't know anything about the guy. The point is all of this stuff about non-complied with services is a total fiction. And this business about him repeatedly failing UAs, which the agency treats as positive, I mean, that's the most ridiculous thing in the world. If he's in Florida and his color comes up on the color wheel, how can he get to HCMC to take a UA in downtown Minneapolis? They made zero effort to arrange for UAs, even if they were needed, to be done anywhere else. So I would submit to you that there was no need for services, and he can't be charged with a failure to comply with services. These are procedural deficits. It's true what Ms. Nicholson says, that I didn't argue the sufficiency of the three statutory grounds. I argued these procedural failings that deprived him of a fair trial. If I were to have argued the three subdivisions, I would have argued that there wasn't clear and convincing evidence. But all they knew about this guy, even as of July, is that he hadn't taken as many UAs as he was supposed to. He had met with the parenting assessor only six times, and there was something else that they weren't satisfied with. And I'll just say a few more words about this alleged plan to give the child back to the grandmother. This was CF's and her mother's plan. JB never agreed to it. He did ask the parenting assessor about it, and I believe she said that that would be precluded, but he never intended to do that. He testified, I wouldn't let the mother see the child unless she did some services, and I wouldn't let the maternal grandmother see the child at all. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Garman. Thank you to all counsel.